This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, we have Lisa Owsley with After the Harvest in studio. After the Harvest is a locally run 501c3 to get produce that would otherwise be wasted from farmers' fields to the tables of families in need. So stay tuned for our interview. But first, I'm Natural Lee, and I have your headlines. ClimateCentral.org reports, the largest concentration of methane emissions seen in the U.S. over the past decade has been detected by satellite over the most active coal bed methane production area in the country, the Four Corners area of New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, and Arizona, according to a new study published last Thursday. The hotspot, which predates the current hydraulic fracturing or fracking boom in the region, is over the San Juan Basin, where energy companies have been drilling and producing natural gas from methane deposits found in underground coal seams for many years. The natural gas is composed of more than 95% methane. The study, published Thursday in the journal Environmental Research Letters, shows that methane emissions from traditional oil and gas development are significantly underestimated over large scales, its authors say. Over the span of a century, methane is 35 times as strong as carbon dioxide as a climate change-driving greenhouse gas and has a significant effect on exacerbating global warming in the short term. Led by researchers from the University of Michigan and Caltech, the study analyzes 7 years of emissions data from 2003 to 2009, captured by a now-decommissioned European Space Agency satellite that measured global greenhouse gases between 2002 and 2012. It's the same satellite a recent Harvard University study used to determine that livestock digestion released more methane than the oil and gas industry did in 2004. The hot spot the researchers found, which was validated by ground instruments, covers about 2,500 square miles over the Four Corners area where coal bed methane development in the area released about 650,000 tons of methane into the atmosphere annually for each of the 7 years. That amounts to 10% of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's official estimate of methane emissions for all of the U.S. during those years. No higher rate of methane emissions was found anywhere else in the U.S. during that time period. The research follows numerous new studies that show that natural gas production and distribution leak an amount of methane that scientists have yet to fully quantify. The studies also suggest leaking methane is not figured into official government estimates of total U.S. methane emissions. EcoWatch.com reports, the movement on college campuses to divest from fossil fuels has been growing in the U.S. and currently has commitments from 13 schools, including Stanford University. Now, Glasgow University has become the first academic institution in Europe to decide to divest. This is a victory for the student-led Glasgow University Climate Action Society. As in the U.S., the European movement is led primarily by students. After a year-long campaign involving more than 1,300 students, freedom of information requests, rallies, flash mobs, fake oil spills, and banner drops, the University of Glasgow Court voted today to remove £18 million, about $29 million, from investments in fossil fuel companies over a 10-year period, and to freeze further investments from its entire £128 million endowment. ClimateCentral.org reports, coastal American cities are sinking into saturated new realities, new analysis has confirmed. Sea level rise has given a boost to high tides, which are regularly overtopping streets, floorboards, and other low-lying areas that had long existed in relatively dehydrated harmony with nearby waterfronts. The trend is projected to worsen sharply in the coming years. A new report released by the Union of Concerned Scientists late on Tuesday forecasts that by 2030, at least 180 floods will strike during high tides every year in Annapolis, Maryland. In some cases, such flooding will occur twice in a single day, since tides come in and out about two times daily. By 2045, that's also expected to be the case in Washington, D.C., Atlantic City, New Jersey, and 14 other East Coast and Gulf Coast locations out of 52 analyzed by the Union of Concerned Scientists. The 52 locations, from Portland to Freeport, Texas, were selected because the National Weather Service issues flood advisories based on local tide gauge recordings there. That allowed the researchers to confidently use the tide gauge data to calculate historical flooding rates and compare those with projected future rates. In the absence of flood-deflecting marshes, seawalls, or levees, two-thirds of the 52 communities studied can expect a tripling in the frequency of high-tide flooding during the next 15 years, the researchers concluded. Half of the communities studied are expected to be flooded more than two dozen times every year by 2030. The research was published as the double-decker effects of rising seas and king tides spectacularly flood Floridian shorelines. Without the 8 inches of sea level rise recorded since pre-industrial times, one of the hallmarks of climate change, those king tides would not have the same flooding effects. The projections were published 4 months after the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration released an analysis of recent rise of tidal floods, which it calls nuisance floods. That analysis revealed that nuisance floods were occurring now in some places nearly 10 times more often than had been the case in 1960s. And we have a spot we'd like to listen to before we get started with the interview.
Due to the generosity of local orthodontists in the greater Kansas City area, Smiles Change Lives has openings left in 2014 for kids needing braces who qualify for the program. This is unusual, and we don't want any spots to go unfilled. Parents with children 10 to 18 in need of braces should go to smileschangelives.org/apply. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
If your unemployment benefits have been denied in the last 30 days, you may be eligible for free legal assistance from attorneys and law students through the UMKC School of Law Unemployment Benefits Clinic. To find out if you are eligible for these free legal services, your unemployment benefits must have been denied in the last 30 days. Contact the clinic today and talk to an attorney about your case free of charge. Call 816-235-5129. Again, call 816-235-5129.
All right. I would like to welcome Lisa Owsley to our show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And you are with After the Harvest.
Yes.
Please tell us, what is After the Harvest?
Well, our tagline says it all. It's healthy food for hungry people. And we are a hunger relief, local hunger relief organization focused on getting fresh, nutritious food to people who can't afford to feed their families.
So where does this food come from?
Well, we're talking fresh produce, the best food you can feed your body.
Mm-hmm.
We work with farmers and growers, produce industry partners like packers and truckers to get produce that's going to be wasted. And we get it to agencies and pantries and food banks that take care of hungry people in our community.
So how do you get this food to the pantries and then to the people in need? What's the process?
Well, we have two programs by which we acquire food. We have what we call our gleaning network, which is an effort to organize volunteers to go out into farmers' fields and orchards after they're done harvesting their crops to gather what's left. There's always, they see, I think it's like 10% of the crop stays in the field. Maybe it's 20, I can't remember. It's surprising. But this is good, healthy, fresh, nutritious food. It was just left behind because it was too small or too large, the wrong color or shape. For some reason, the person who was harvesting that crop determined that it wasn't going to sell, so they left it in the field. Or the farmer used mechanical equipment, and maybe there's a hollow in that field, and the machine went right over that hollow. So all of the food grown in that little hollow is just going to rot. It's going to be left in the field. We work with our volunteers to go out and pick that food, Again, that's fields and orchards. That's every kind of fruits and vegetables you can imagine. We simply go out and pick that food that's been left. We bag and box it up. This is fresh, locally grown, vine-ripened, wonderful, delicious food. We bag and box it up, and we send our volunteers out from that field with their cars full of eggplant and cucumbers and tomatoes and all this wonderful, wonderful food, and they take it to local pantries. We work with a lot of local pantries, but we have individually delivered food to at least 42 local pantries since we opened our new organization.
So who are your volunteers?
Our volunteers are wonderful, wonderful, generous people who come from all different walks of life. Some of them are corporate. Some of them are Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts. Some of them come from a Sunday school class or a knitting circle. We just have all sorts of neat people who see the value of our work and want to help. We work with a lot of young people. We love young people. Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and school classes. We love to bring them out to a field and just let them see how their food's grown, what it looks like in its natural state, and give them an opportunity to help other people.
Well, when did After the Harvest come about?
Actually, After the Harvest opened its doors on May 19th of this year. We're a brand new organization. We actually were formed out of another organization that actually opened in Kansas City in 2008. And I was the director of that program as well. It was called Society of St. Andrew's Western Headquarters. Mm-hmm. We were that organization and worked for 6 years as that organization, and we actually saved about 15 million pounds of fresh food to feed people in need. But then we determined over about a year's time period that it would be more beneficial for our area if we were to be a local organization. So we decided to break off from that national organization, and we started our own 501c3 called After the Harvest, Healthy Food for Hungry People.
I love that. So you stay in the Kansas City area. How far do you branch out?
Well, with our gleaning program, we have farms as far as 100, 150 miles out. So we do kind of organize gleanings a little bit distant, but we stay in this region. But our second program, the second way we get food is to work with commercial growers and packers and truckers and other people who handle large volumes of produce. And we partner with those folks to get excess, graded out, and sometimes rejected loads of fresh produce, which we direct to harvesters. So that it can be dispersed out throughout the community. I mean, harvesters is our best distribution partner. They have worked with 620 plus agencies in the metro area and in the 26 county area. So our food goes out wide and far, and through that, for instance, in the last 2 weeks, we have brought harvesters 2 truckloads of white potatoes, which everyone knows how to eat a white potato, mm-hmm. right? Well, and you can eat them in healthy, you can eat white potatoes in a healthy manner, so they're good for you. Mm-hmm. But we brought in 2 truckloads. That's 44,000 pounds a load. So that's 88,000 pounds of white potatoes.
That's amazing.
Yes. We also brought in a truckload of sweet potatoes out of Mississippi. Wonderful, nutritious.
So you're able to redirect these foods from the trucks that would just be wasted?
Well, these particular potatoes, all of these loads came from farms. Mm-hmm. And typically, whenever a farm, when they harvest their potatoes, they grade them. And These are B-grade potatoes. So we might have some potatoes that are as big as a baby's head, and then we might have some potatoes that are really, really, really small, but they're all nutritious, good food. And so these are the kinds of things. They're abnormal sizes. They might have marks or whatever on them.
Right.
Or they just simply might be excess. We have growers who... they have sold all they can, and so these they donate to help feed other people.
So this, first, what is gleaning, in case someone doesn't know what gleaning means?
Well, gleaning actually has its roots in Scripture. I mean, in the Old Testament of the Bible, you can read about gleaning in the book of Ruth. It's actually their... one of their welfare programs, if you will, or one of the ways in which they helped people who were struggling back in those times. Mm-hmm. They didn't have state funded programs, but they had rules where they told farmers to save the corners of their field and not to harvest twice, but to leave that food for widows and orphans and what they call travelers, which I think meant homeless folks. But people who were struggling to take care of their families, that was their program back then, to get people, those people, something to eat. But those people did it themselves. We kind of put a new spin on that, in that we invite volunteers from different faith groups or civic groups, companies, corporations, foundations, all sorts of different folks to come out and help us get that wonderful food, and we get it to feed folks who can't afford the food.
So gleaning is the act of getting food from these fields that would otherwise be wasted. Now, what did these farmers do after the harvest came to work with them? What did they do with the food, the excess?
Farmers don't want to waste their food. They really don't. And I'm sure that they got as much as they could, or called their neighbors in, or got their kids to pick as much as they could, things like that. But the fact of the matter is, there's a lot of food that goes to waste. And it's just a fact of farming. And if the stuff is not going to bring you money, and it's more than your family and maybe your neighbors can eat, there's nothing... it's not worth your time to go out and get it out of the field. So we help farmers. We help them in two ways. We help them prevent the waste of good food. We also help them in that we track all of the donations that they give us. And at the end of the year, we give them an itemized report that says, thank you so much for supporting hungry people in your community. You donated 1,000 pounds of tomatoes, 800 pounds of peppers, 900 pounds of cucumbers, that kind of thing.
That's amazing.
And yes, and then they can use it in their in preparing their taxes, the deductibles.
And then also, what does rotting food do to our environment?
Well, that's something that we just heard about, methane gas. And rotting food is one of the largest contributors, not obviously the largest, but one of the largest contributors to methane gas in our air, you know, greenhouse gases. So by gleaning, we're helping our environment because we're preventing the needless waste of good food, and we are cutting in on some of that methane gas. Very important.
And then also, the food goes to people who would otherwise not have any food, and let alone healthy food, right from
there,
the vine.
There you go. That's the thing. In our town, we have probably 375,000 people that seek emergency food assistance each year. That's not just in our town. That's in the Harvester Service area. That's a 26-county area. One in five children is food insecure in our area, which is horrible.
So tell me, after the harvest, how many farms do you work with?
We actually engage with well over 100, but since we've gotten in our new organization, we've probably worked with 45, 50, but we've gotten assurances from all sorts of farmers that they are glad to work with us as soon as they have food to give us.
I just feel like this is, I mean, it could sound like bad news, you know, excess of food going to waste hungry people, but it could also be good news. There's extra food.
Absolutely.
You know, and if people are hungry, I mean, there is a solution.
Well, exactly.
This is the solution.
Absolutely. And not only that, but we talk about food insecure people in our country. We don't talk about starvation. It's more malnutrition, because mm-hmm. what the folks who can't afford to buy fresh groceries, what they're limited to is often canned, packaged, highly processed, low nutrient value food.
Chips, candy bars,
pop, exactly, crackers. Mac and
stores.
Cheese. Yeah, mac and... You know, there's nothing wrong with a plate of mac and cheese unless that's what you get every night and it's not accompanied by fresh vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody needs fruit and vegetables to survive and thrive in this world. And we want to give people the opportunity, even if they can't afford to buy that fresh food. And we have lots of partners we work with. It's really, really exciting. We work with, there's all sorts of people in our community who are very interested in feeding people and in fighting these food deserts that we have all around our town,
mm-hmm.
and getting food into these areas so that people can survive and thrive and grow and develop their brains and have good lives and all the things that come with eating right.
So is After the Harvest looking for more volunteers?
Desperately. All the time. We always need volunteers. In fact, we would have been in an apple orchard this morning if it hadn't been raining so hard.
Mm-hmm. So how could our listeners get in contact with you all?
Well, you can find out a lot more good information and check out our cool website. It's www.afterTheHarvestKC.org. You can go out there and sign up, and we will get you plugged in and let you know when each gleaning that we do is posted on our webpage, so you can see where we're going to glean, what we're going to be doing, the general location of the farm. We don't hand the addresses out until after you've committed mm-hmm. to glean. But you can find out what we're doing and what's happening. It's a lot of fun.
Now, if I come and I volunteer to help pick apples, do I get to eat an apple or two while I'm there?
You sure do. We really encourage everyone to get their fill while they're gleaning, because a lot of folks, if they've never been out to a farm, never picked a fresh peach,
mm-hmm.
they might not even know what a real tree-ripened, sweet peach tastes like, and you cannot equal it in this world, I don't think. It's just so good. So good.
After the Harvest also has a Facebook page, After the Harvest KC.
That's
right.
That
in.
Absolutely.
And if you have any questions for Lisa, you can call us in at 816-931-5534. And you could ask us right now on the air if you have a question.
I have a couple questions.
All right, Mike.
Well, first of all, a comment. We were talking about the environmental impact. One thing that occurs to me is that, you know, I read a couple years ago that the average forkful of food traveled 1,000 miles to get there. That's an awful lot of fuel, and that's an awful lot of, carbon footprint to make that happen. And regardless of whether someone's economic status. And so After the Harvest is really mitigating that carbon footprint right there.
Absolutely. The food that we glean travels from the farm to the pantry that's going to be distributing it. There's really as few miles as possible in between. We really try to be direct. We do move a lot of truckloads of food, and that's a different thing. But the gleaning, we're doing more and more gleaning, and gleaning is a really small footprint. And, you know, as our community grows more food. I fully believe that we are at the cusp of a lot more food being grown in our area.
Mm-hmm.
And as we grow more food, there's going to be more food to glean.
That's
and,
right.
And more food to distribute.
And I think a lot of people want to get involved in this new movement, but might not necessarily want to make the raised beds and till the, you know, food, not lawns. Not everybody wants to do that, but they are still interested in having fresh foods and being a part of that. But like you said, there's all these farms and there's this excess food, so you can participate by volunteering with After the Harvest and,
absolutely,
and picking food that is waiting to be picked and eaten.
That's right. And let me give you an idea of what a gleaning is like.
Okay.
I'm going to go and glean strawberries.
Mm, sounds great.
Yay. Our strawberry farm is just east of Lawrence. And so we give all of our gleaners all of the instructions that they need to get to the farm, because they need to do that themselves. Mm-hmm. But we will tell them where to go, what to wear, what to bring, give them the directions to the farm, all the weather conditions, all that good jazz. So, okay, it's my first strawberry gleaning, I know I need to wear long pants, and I need to wear socks and tennis shoes, and I got to remember my sunscreen and my hat, because mm-hmm. it's going to be warm. And so I get all dressed, I get my water bottle, and I set out for the farm, drive the distance, and I arrive at the farm. We have a gleaning, a waiver that we use to protect our farmers, and so as a volunteer, I would get my waiver signed and report for duty, and the field supervisor would tell me what we need to do, how we do it, how you pick a strawberry properly,
mm-hmm.
How you protect the rest of the plant. She would give you the containers you need to put the strawberries in and all that fun stuff, mm-hmm. and you simply start picking strawberries.
Mm.
And we glean in the morning whenever it's hot, and then the afternoon when it's cool, mm-hmm. so that our volunteers are their most comfortable. And we simply go out and pick the food, load it up in containers, and put it in volunteers' cars, and they drive it to a location where it can be used. And who doesn't like fresh strawberries?
I don't know. Mike, did you have a question?
Well, I do want to remind our listeners they can join in the conversation at 816-931-5534. But, yeah, while we're waiting for that, so here we are in the middle of October. How have your needs changed? Surely you're doing something different than you were doing in July.
Yes, we are. It's different all year round. Where we were picking strawberries in May and June, we're picking apples now, and we're picking greens and squash and wonderful, wonderful
sweet potatoes.
You know, the sweet potatoes, I think the sweet potatoes have all been dug. Although, you know, I think there are some people who are still digging their sweet potatoes.
Okay, yeah. Well, I need some sweet potatoes and greens.
Such good food, excellent food.
Well, that's great.
So, yes, we are going to be busy probably till the first one or two really hard frosts, and then we'll... Although, you know, I know that there have been years we were picking greens in December.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So really, we are like farmers, so our work really depends upon the weather.
Mm-hmm.
But there's lots of food grown in this town, or in this area.
And what other fruits besides apples? Any other fruits?
Right now, we finished picking Asian pears in September, and we are picking apples. I am not sure the time frame on pears, but I don't think that we've actually gleaned any pears this year.
I have a question about your volunteers. I'm imagining it's a combination of, you know, some diehards that keep coming back for more, and some people that may come once or twice.
Absolutely, absolutely. We have wonderful volunteers, like you said, who are diehard. They love to glean. It's fun. You get connected with nature. You get to dig in the dirt. It's peaceful and relaxing. And you know that at the end of the short 3 hour, 4 hour period that you're there, that you're going to make the difference in somebody's life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's meaningful work. It's not mentally taxing. Although, you know, there's a lot to learn. You learn how to pick a peach the proper way, or how to pick an apple so that you don't pull the spur off.
Mm-hmm.
If you pull the spur off, then the apple doesn't grow next year in that place. Mm-hmm. So there's all sorts of wonderful things to learn. And my colleague, Corrine Page, does an excellent job. She is the program director, and she knows the ins and outs of all of our farms. Actually, one thing we do during this time of year is we help the farmers who grow food for us, mm-hmm. specifically. So we get the first harvest on some rows. And those farmers, we actually help during mm-hmm. the off season to do things that they need to do to prepare for the next season. So maybe we're pruning strawberry plants, you know, or maybe we're, you know, there's all sorts of things, digging rocks even. There's all sorts of things you need to do to help our farmers, and we do those kinds of things.
I'd also like to point out that this is a great thing to volunteer for. This is also a way to get to know where food comes from, because we're so disconnected from that. But also, it's more than just volunteer. It's environmentally. This is activism, is what this is.
Yeah,
this is saying today I'm not going to spend my money at a corporate grocery store that trucked in the food and whatever and does not really have the local best intentions maybe. And I'm going to do something about that. I'm going to do something about that. And I'm going to feed people who can't afford that food anyways while I'm doing this. I just really appreciate the work that you're doing, and I encourage people, our listeners, to log on to Facebook and type in After the Harvest KC, or you could go to their website directly, aftertheharvestkc.org, and find out how you can get involved and learn and be a part of the solution.
Absolutely. We welcome people. We collaborate with a lot of people in this town to make our work happen, because we have a very small team. We have only 2 full-time employees and 1 part-time employee.
Mm-hmm.
But we have moved more than 770,000 pounds in the last 5 months.
What?
Since May 19th, we have moved more than 770,000 pounds of food. That means we've moved it to feed people in need. We've gotten it from places and taken it to Harvesters or to St. James Place or mm-hmm. to Episcopal Community Services. We have all sorts of wonderful partners in our area mm-hmm. who are bent on making sure that people get a chance to eat good food, whether they can afford it or not.
This is the best news I've heard all day.
Yay, it's fun.
So, do you have any events coming up?
Yes, in fact, we sure do. We have a Harvest Happy Hour fundraiser coming up October 23rd. That's Thursday, October 23rd, from 5 to 6:30 p.m. And it's going to be an opportunity to share our news with our community, to let them come and listen to what we're doing and support us, because this is a nonprofit. We survive on the grace of others. Mm-hmm. We have wonderful support. We have some wonderful supporters in this town.
Mm-hmm.
We have foundations like Healthcare Foundation, Hall Family Foundation, mm-hmm. Hallmark Corporate Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, wonderful people who believe in what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And J.R. Albert Foundation is another foundation that's supporting us. And we are truly grateful for that support, because it allows us to make this big difference in the lives of others.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. So we would love it if you would come out. Our event is going to be held at the Founders Hall at Grace and Holy Trinity Cathedral. That's at 415 West 13th Street in Kansas City. That's really the intersection of Broadway and 13th Street is where it is.
Okay.
Yeah, and if you can go out to our website, we've got a great big graphic on the front page of our announcement to this event, and we would love it if you would like to come out and attend this event. We would love it if you would RSVP to events@afterTheHarvestKC.org and just let us know you're coming so we can plan. We're going to have beverages and appetizers and a fun program and a video and all sorts of fun stuff.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So Grace and Holy Trinity Church, Founders Hall, 415 West 13th Street. We'll post this event on our Eco Radio Facebook page. But as she stated, Lisa stated, you could go to their website, aftertheharvestkc.org.
Absolutely.
That's wonderful. We'll probably just have a few minutes left, or maybe 10 minutes left with Lisa, and then we're going to hear from Elaine. So that means there's still some time for folks to call in if they have a question or comment about After the Harvest and the fine work they're doing. And that number is 816-931-5534. So what happens in January? Is that off season?
Well, you know, in January we attend conferences, we refuel our brains, we write grants, we also move large truckloads of fresh produce into harvesters. Because we are able to access food outside of the harvester's service area, we are able to bring fresh produce by the truckload into harvesters all throughout the year, actually. Mm-hmm. But we do a lot of work in January, February, March with growers from the South and food banks producers in southern states, Arizona, New Mexico, that region. Mm-hmm. So we are moving food and working hard all year long. And with the development of hoop houses in our area, we are starting to glean earlier. Mm-hmm. We've gleaned in March in hoop houses. We have, yes.
What is hoop houses?
A hoop house is like a greenhouse, but it is not heated. It uses the sun, mm-hmm, to heat. You know, it's like plastic instead of glass, but it looks like a big plastic greenhouse is what it looks like, and it's a method by which our growers are able to extend their growing season. They start planting in March, We've gleaned in March.
So that's for someone who doesn't grow food. Unusual to be able to pick food in March. When is the harvest?
Well, you know, that's interesting too, because we start harvesting some things really early. We start harvesting strawberries and greens, mm-hmm, pretty early, actually, May. Mm-hmm. Some stuff I think May is a better time frame, more safer time frame.
But you're getting greens now, though, too.
Yes. So. Greens are the last thing to go and the first thing to come on, and they're wonderful. We do arugula and kale, several kinds of kale, and chard, collard greens. It's just all wonderful, nourishing food.
Mm-hmm.
Just excellent. Love to eat it.
Me too. Put it in your smoothie.
Absolutely. It's delicious.
So what kind of feedback do you get from pantries? I bet they're loving this.
You know, we have... here's an example. I was talking with a pantry earlier this year, and I asked to try to understand the impact of our work on pantries. I asked him what his budget for purchasing produce was. And he told me, he said, we don't have a budget for purchasing produce. In fact, they didn't even have a budget for purchasing food, period.
What?
He said, we have a budget for transportation.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll go and pick up food that's donated. Mm-hmm. But they don't have a budget for purchasing food. So in other words, we have a great impact on the pantries we serve, because what we bring them is not food that has been sitting around forever and nobody will touch it. And so they're, rather than dump it, they'll donate it. It's our food. The food we bring them is good quality, fresh produce that's vine ripened and is really delicious. Mm. So we have a big impact on the bottom line of the agencies we serve.
Have you gotten any feedback from individuals who have benefited from the food?
Yes.
Share a story with us.
Well, we have one particular grandmother that I heard from. She hadn't had she got a hold of some sweet corn at the pantry she was at, and she said that sweet corn was so good that she just kept hoping that nobody else in her family would see the sweet corn and want some because she wanted it all for herself. She said, I'm generally a very generous person, but that sweet corn was so good. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to eat every last ear for myself.
Well, I hope she did.
Yeah.
Grandmas get to do whatever they want.
Yeah. It's important.
Mm-hmm. I've spoken with Corrine Page.
Yes.
And she told me about a woman who just, she said that was, she hadn't had greens like that since she was a young girl living in the South. Like, she just hadn't had access to that, yeah, that quality, that good taste of produce just since she was a kid, and it just brought tears to her eyes.
Yeah, it is. It really matters to the people we help. I truly believe that. Absolutely.
Well, we're running out of time. We've got Elaine, but we've just got a couple more minutes to wrap up here. We've just got three or four minutes.
All right.
So I do want to ask something about that. Do people who are the recipients of the food ever get inspired to become gleaners?
Yes, they do. Absolutely. We take people out gleaning all the time. The issue with that is that oftentimes people who are struggling to feed their families also have issues with transportation.
Right.
And because we don't provide transportation, that kind of cuts into that. But we absolutely do welcome people who come out and glean with us. If they're struggling, or if they know of a family personally who is struggling, we absolutely ask them to take food.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So this might be a good time to just remind people how to contact you.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Also remind people about the event again coming up.
Yes. Please, you can learn more about After the Harvest on the web at www.aftertheharvestkc.org. You can reach out to us. We have our office number is 816-921-1903. Please check us out on Facebook at After the Harvest KC. And we do have a fundraising event coming up on Thursday, October 23rd, and the name of that is our Harvest Happy Hour. It happens from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at Grace and Holy Trinity Cathedral's Founders Hall at 415 West 13th Street in downtown Kansas City.
That's incredible.
Excellent. Well, I do appreciate you joining us here today, Lisa.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I hope that some of our listeners will go to the website and sign up to help on the gleanings for the end of the season.
Come and glean, yes.
Yes, and stay in contact for the next season as well. This is really important work, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, please let us know how else we can help.
I will. Thank you.
Okay, we'll be back with Elaine right after these messages.
As part of the partnership that developed between the Cherokee Christian Church Congregation and the Global Montessori Academy, there will be the first annual Cherokee Coat Drive and Pancake Breakfast to carry on the legacy of giving Saturday, October 18th, 8:30 to 11:30 a.m. at the Global Montessori Academy, 7487 Cherokee Drive, Perry Village, Kansas. Coats and cakes will be open to the public and winter donations accepted on the day of the event. All you can eat pancakes and sausage may be purchased. Donations may include newly or gently used coats, mittens, hats, winter underwear, socks, and blankets. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Did you know that you can donate your unwanted car, boat, truck, or motorcycle to KKFI Radio and get a tax deduction for your donation? Find out more by calling KKFI at 816-931-3122. This is Pat Fisher from Kansas City, a volunteer for 90.1 FM KKFI, our community radio station.
Okay, I think we have Elaine on the line. Are you there, Elaine?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, hello to Aaron. Hello to you, Mike.
Hello,
and it's nice to be on the air again.
Yeah.
Your listeners may not know, but I'm an occasional programmer and usually cover wildlife issues. And we have a short segment now on something that is going on the Kansas side of the state line that we're very concerned about. The Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks and Tourism is the agency in Kansas that is, by statute, to protect all non-game species in the state, as well as create regulations for animals that are hunted, and to protect the listed species, endangered and threatened species, or species in need of conservation. And every 5 years, there's a review of these lists, and there is a body of scientists, an advisory group, a 7-member body of wildlife biologists who represent state, federal, non-government organizations, who review the list, and they do this on the basis of a petition process. Different entities can petition the agency to add a species to the list, to change the status of a particular species, or to remove species, and they have to provide scientific evidence. That is the nature of the petition, and that's stated in the statute. We're up right now into a 5-year annual review process, and there were petitioners from Johnson County, Kansas, particularly some utilities, Water One and Johnson County Wastewater and the City of Olathe, petitioned Kansas Wildlife and Parks to remove from the threatened species list 2 snakes currently listed as threatened, and they wanted them removed based on some science. They hired a consultant who prepared a petition. And one snake, the Science Advisory Task Force, agreed should be downlisted or delisted off the threatened species list. But the other one, called a red belly or a red-bellied snake, the common name varies according to the source, they unanimously, 7-0, recommended to remain on the threatened list. And this recommendation is then passed from the advisory committee to the secretary, an appointed, governor-appointed secretary of Kansas Department of Wildlife, Parks, and Tourism. His name is Robin Jennison. But based on reasons that he has provided on the record, political, economic reasons, because of the development going on in Johnson County, is being slowed by the presence of these 2 species in question, the smooth earth snake and the red-bellied snake. He has gone against the advisory body's recommendation to hold on, to retain the threatened status, and to delist the snake to a status called species in need of conservation. It's kind of a technical phrase, but what it means is that the protective measures currently in place to preserve the habitat or to even mitigate for loss of habitat if development does occur, and it does, despite the snakes being here, those measures go away. And the issue is really not so much about this red-bellied snake, and for the audience's pleasure, this is a snake that is 10 inches long or less. It lives under leaf litter, particularly moist leaf litter in forested areas, but can also be found in urban areas. There's only one snake that's ever been found in Johnson County, but it is found in other counties along the eastern border of Kansas. This snake is a harmless snake. It eats slugs and snails primarily that live in these wet environments. So it's not harmful to anybody. It's just that it's in the way of development, and its habitat is being destroyed, and we're afraid that the snake will go from threatened to endangered. That is the whole point of having a species listed as threatened. The real issue here, as I said, is really not the snake. It's about the process. And the Sierra Club, of which I am a member, in fact, I'm the endangered species chair now, has objected to this process. We have filed comments opposing the use of politics to trump science. We believe that there is no reason in this case that the secretary really should use to override this scientific recommendation, that the findings of the task force should hold. And what we're doing tonight, I mean, as part of this, is to make something of a plea to the audience. A lot of environmental groups that are interested in preserving and conserving species, wildlife species in Kansas are stepping up to the plate. But what the commission, which is a body of seven men currently, who oversee the agency, the commission is going to vote on October 16th. That is coming up fast. That's this Thursday night. And it's going to happen in the city of Salina, Kansas, at a restaurant called Martinelli's. I'm not asking people to go to Martinelli's. That's a long drive to go and talk about this snake unless you're really committed. I'll be there anyway. But you can participate. You can send comments directly to KDWPT, it's called, the Kansas Department of Wildlife, Parks, and Tourism. The name of the person accepting these comments is Sheila Kimmeth, and that she's got an email, Sheila, S-H-E-I-L-A dot K-E-M-M-I-S at K-S Outdoors, all one word, ksoutdoors.com. Now, this address is on our website, as well as an alert, a lot of background information, including a technical paper on these two snakes, a fact sheet. There's a petition you can download. Our website is kansas.sierraclub.org. Easy to find, not a problem. And you can use the material we have there. There are hot links there to get you straight to Sheila Kimmeth, and you can leave a comment about using science rather than politics in determining policy for our Kansas wildlife. The issue here is really, the bottom line, is the future of this law, because the law that now protects wildlife will essentially be gutted by the commission if it decides to follow the secretary's recommendation. For the last 40 years that the law has been in place, there's not been one time that the secretary has either modified nor recommended to override the science task force recommendation. And this precedent will essentially put all listed species in Kansas at risk of arbitrary delisting, not based on science, you know, not based on public opinion, but on a petition submitted by developers or utilities. We have real issues with that because all wildlife is protected through this law, and ultimately we may lose the law through process here. And the commissioners are appointed, as is the secretary. They are not accountable to the people of Kansas in this position. They're not elected. So, again, our website for more information is kansas.sierraclub.org. And I appreciate an opportunity to pitch this. I think this is a huge issue here in Kansas, frankly.
Well, thanks for checking in with us. That's what we're here for. I mean, there seems to be a time sensitivity to this, so certainly we would have been dropping the ball if we didn't seize this opportunity to get you making folks aware of what's going on in Kansas.
Well, and if you visit that page, you will be able to find a link to the Kansas Sierra Club Facebook page. And there's a link on some of the Facebook posts that are there to an online petition that we put up with MoveOn.org. And you can click there to sign that petition. If you do nothing else, go tonight, find that online petition on our website, on our Facebook post. Click on it and put your name up there. It's the least you can do.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Elaine.
Thank you for having me. Have a good evening, guys.
All right. Great to hear your voice. All right. Bye-bye.
I'm Naturally again, and I have your events. October 14th, 2014, from 7 p.m. to 8:30, the Environmental Action Committee of Village, Church, and Sustainable Sanctuary Coalition are co-sponsoring the presentation, Residential Solar Panels. Bob Solgar from Solar Design Studio will discuss how solar works, components of solar installation, system sizes for a home, and financing. And let's see, they will donate $100 to SSC for every person who gets solar panels as a result of this class. Both presenters will provide details and answer your questions. It's a free event, and again, it's on Tuesday, tomorrow, October 14th, at Village Presbyterian Church, room 132. And this is in Mission, Kansas. You can find this event details on greenabilitymagazine.org. The Land Institute, internationally famous and locally obscure event, is being hosted by the Master Gardeners of Greater Kansas City. This takes place October 16th at 6:30 p.m. They will feature a speaker, Josh Svati, and he will discuss how the Land Institute is working to reverse the antagonism between agriculture and nature. Using nature as the standard, Land Institute scientists are developing perennial mixtures that can produce food in harmony with the wild. The Institute believes that healthy natural prairie ecosystems provide the information to direct our paths, information that is often disregarded when we choose the agriculture of annual grains some 10,000 years ago. The program will be held Thursday, October 16th at 6:30 p.m. at the Country Club Christian Church located at 6101 Ward Parkway, Kansas City, Missouri. This event is free and open to the public. No registration is required, and you can find more information by visiting www.mggkc.org. And Tuesday, October 21st, join the Kansas Green Party along with several other groups to stand for environmental justice. We want water, conservation, sustainable land use, and a break from fossil fuels. They think that people cannot live without clean air and water, and so do I. So after the State House event, they will have dinner and discuss moving the party forward in Kansas. And they are, that event is at El Centenario at 13th and Kansas Avenue at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, October 21st. I'd also like to remind you about the Harvest Happy Hour by After the Harvest KC, which is Thursday, October 23rd from 5 to 6:30 p.m. at Grace and Holy Trinity Cathedral at 13th and Broadway.